Zombies, the walking dead, the slow-moving but inescapable pop culture phenomenon. There are zombie survival guides, books about economic policy with zombies, even Pride and Prejudice with zombies. These are fictional zombies, but you're going to hear right now about real zombies. Zombie parasites. They pose a health care problem for adults, but what they do to animals is going to amaze and frighten you. David Hughes is an assistant professor of entomology and biology at Penn State. He's here to tell us all about it. David, thanks for talking to us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ross.
Let's start small. What's a zombie ant and what makes it a zombie?
A zombie ant is an ant which was formerly rather a regular part of the colony, a worker who would go out and collect food. And during the exploration in the forest where it's foraging for food, it comes across a patch of small spores. And these are fungal spores, which are parasites that enter the body and over a period of about 2 weeks grow inside the hapless ant. And then at the ideal time in the parasite's development, start to control the behavior, producing chemicals not dissimilar to the ones we just heard about in cannabis, chemicals which control the individual's behavior, making that individual leave the colony and die on a very special location, which is on the underside of a leaf. The fungus, which is a microbe, instructs the ant to bite deep into the vein of the leaf just above the foraging trails of the colony. Because what happens next is that the parasite kills the ant and then grows an enormously large stalk out of the back of its head to produce spores which shoot down and continue to cycle again.
That is grotesque. Then what happens?
Well, that's the reason why it's called a zombie, because the parasite is controlling the ant to go to the ideal location where the fungus can reproduce.
And so it's these parasites are kind of taking over the host. What happens with fly parasites that infest bees?
The same thing, in that they cause the individual bees to leave the nest. So in this case, the fly parasite will emerge as a rather large insect from the body of its host, which is also an insect. And this wouldn't happen very efficiently inside the hive because the other bees would attack the emerging fly. So the fly controls the bee behavior, making it go out to some other part of the environment where it can come emerge from the body unmolested.
Now, there's also the example of the wasp zombie parasite. It infects caterpillars and changes their behavior in a really interesting way. What happens?
Yeah, this is a really interesting and quite freaky example where you again have an insect being infected by another insect, which is a parasitic insect called a parasitoid, and it's going to emerge from the body of the caterpillar. But what it does is it just hangs around very close to where that caterpillar is, and it leaves a large component of chemicals inside the caterpillar. And the caterpillar stays in exactly the ideal location, and then it acts as a bodyguard. So anything coming towards those parasitic wasps, which could threaten it, and the wasp is not able to protect itself, the caterpillar does the job of a bodyguard. So itself is not parasitized anymore, but it's still acting in the ways that the parasite wants.
Now, there's a video that you sent us, and we have it on our Facebook page, KUOW's The Conversation. They can look at it right now, and you can see worms coming out of crickets. What does the worm get the cricket to do?
This worm is infecting the cricket, and as the cricket is moving around the forest, it'll eat these small eggs of the parasite, and over about a year, the worm develops to be this grotesquely large creature inside the body of the cricket. Now, it needs to go on to the next stage in its development, which is to mate inside a body of water, and as you can well appreciate, crickets are not natural swimmers, but this worm manipulates the brain of the cricket, making it go to a body of water, such as a small pool in a forest, and jump in. And this happens with great precision around about 12 o'clock at night during the months of July and August. And the parasite controls the brain and essentially makes the cricket seem incredibly thirsty. And the cricket launches itself into a pool, or in the case of a swimming pool like in the video, exactly because the parasite needs to get somewhere and uses the muscles and the brain and the body of the host to get there.
Then it's goodbye, cricket. Goodbye, host.
Not always. Sometimes the crickets can get out of the pool. Sometimes, rather challengingly, the cricket is eaten before it gets to the pool by a frog or even a fish if it gets into the pool. And then the wily parasite is able to emerge from the stomach of the frog and then come out of its cricket host and even out of the predator which has eaten its cricket host out to its nose, for example.
Wow. We're talking about wily zombie parasites with David Hughes, assistant professor of entomology and biology at Penn State. And let's get back to people. What about humans being taken over by zombie parasites, something called Toxoplasma gondii? I understand the CDC estimates 60 million men, women, and children in the U.S. may be infected. What goes on here?
This is a parasite which controls the behavior of rats, causing them to lose their innate fear of cats and indeed become attracted towards cats in what's called fatal feline attraction. The rat runs up to the cat eats the rat, and the parasite is happy with all this because it's moving from one host, the rat, into the second host, the cat, where it reproduces.
And we have lots of cats around. Is that how it gets to us?
That's the problem. So when we domesticated cats, or cats domesticated us, whichever way you look at it, so we have cats in our homes, and as they poop, we get the oocytes, the small little transmissible stages, and when it gets inside our body, the parasite really doesn't know the difference. So it gets inside our brain, and it won't surprise you to learn that in controlling the rat's behavior, it controls the neurochemistry, and that's exactly what it also does to us. It controls our neurochemistry, our dopamine levels. It's able to play around, and for that reason, it has a very strong link to schizophrenia and even suicide in young mothers.
What are the symptoms? How do you know that you might have been infected by this?
It's hard to look at an individual person and say, aha, that person's infected. But when we kind of measured some behavioral traits of large populations, we can see that infected individuals tend to have delayed risk responses. So they don't react as quickly as uninfected individuals in standardized tests, such as how quickly you catch something. They tend to score significantly higher on psychological tests, such as degrees of neuroticism. Taking more risks, being more neurotic. It's hard to point to an individual and say these individuals are infected, but as an aggregate, we can see infected individuals do have different characteristics.
David, I can see people at home right now warily eyeing Felix the cat over in the corner, wondering if that cat's carrying a parasite, a zombie parasite that's going to get on them. Any way to get your cat checked out?
Well, you can certainly get your cat checked out. What doctors typically recommend also for people who become women who become pregnant is that they avoid cat litters. One of the first tests you get is as a pregnant woman is whether you have this toxoplasma already, because should you pick it up during pregnancy, it can be absolutely disastrous for the developing fetus. So it is a really big public health risk. So get your cat checked out, and also be aware of the neighbor's cats walking into your yard and using your sandbox, for example.
David, you're well known in your field, and I understand you worked as a consultant on the zombie movie World War Z. Is there anything in that movie that you see and you go, yeah, they did that because of what I told them?
Well, there's a couple of things. It was fun to be involved. Zombies are a creation of fiction, of course, but if you imagine what would happen when natural selection was involved, you can start to look at the zombies and say, well, they shouldn't be bumping into each other and fighting to get the host. They should cooperate. And that's exactly what you see in the movie. You see this large cooperative horde, which has what we biologists call a swarm intelligence. And for that reason, they overcome the large obstacles, such as the Jerusalem Wall, which individuals couldn't do. So they cooperate just as if they were ants or herds of buffalo or wildebeest or some such. And another thing you see in the movie is that they make adaptive choices, just like parasitic insects will do. A parasitic insect won't lay its egg anywhere. If a host is already infected, it avoids that host. And that's exactly what you see with the zombies in the movie. Brad Pitt infects himself with a disease in order to prevent himself being attacked and killed by these zombies. So he's using a lesson from biology and weaving it into the story in Hollywood.
Oh, I should have said spoiler alert before you finished that answer.
Yeah.
But you'll have to see the movie to see how that results, how that works out for Brad Pitt. David Hughes, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much indeed, Ross.
David Hughes, assistant professor of entomology and biology at Penn State, talking about zombie parasites. You can find links to what the Centers for Disease Control has to say about Toxoplasma gondii, which we were just talking about, and articles about other parasites and the animal hosts they infect and manipulate. That's at KUOW.org. Just look for The Conversation. I'm Ross Reynolds.